Oh, it's alive! It's alive!
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to another literary edition of Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. Today, we're going to go into the lab and sew together parts from our show and the macabre literature podcast of scholar Robert M. Price, which he calls The Lovecraft Geek. The format of his show is Q&A, and in this episode, Karen Stolzno and I will be playing the part of questioners. Most of these questions come from Monster Talk listeners, and if you enjoy this episode and would like to hear more from the Lovecraft Geek, you can send Bob questions by emailing him or by going to his Facebook page. Links to both of those will be in our show notes at monstertalk.org. Dr. Robert M. Price is a theologian and author of many books. He's also a well-regarded historian of H.P. Lovecraft and edited the venerable fan publication Crypt of Cthulhu. He's written for and edited many anthologies of Lovecraftian work. Links to many of these will be in our show notes for this episode. Bob's also been on Monster Talk before, discussing Cthulhu and the history of Satan. We now descend into the laboratory, where, with scalpel and sledgehammer, we try to mash together our two shows into a hybrid creature for your enjoyment.
Monster Talk.
We're doing a special crossover episode with the Lovecraft Geek. We've got Bob Price back on, and Bob has this podcast in addition to his Bible Geek podcast called the Lovecraft Geek Podcast. And it is a podcast where he answers a variety of questions. And they are great, and you should already be subscribing and download. It's free. We'll put links to that in the show notes. And we'll put links to all of Bob's stuff in the show notes. And Bob has many things to link to. So that make sure you go to monstertalk.org and check out the show notes.
Yeah, we've got lots of listeners who are also Lovecraft fans.
This is true. So do you want to start out with the first one, Karen?
Yeah, sure. So, Bob, you've got a background in theology. And I'm just curious to find out how you went from theology to Lovecraft. And where do you see overlap between the two areas, if you see any overlap?
Well, I do. I was, I guess it was when I was in junior high that I really got serious about religion and discovered Lovecraft. And I never really saw much of a contradiction, as I'm afraid some do. I eventually, years later, wrote an essay about this called Christians in Horror Fiction, where I tried to show that contrary to this hysteria over Dungeons and Dragons, that most people have the ability to draw a line between reality and fantasy. Well, I'm no longer a religious believer, so I wouldn't quite put it that way. But for the sake of those who do believe that their religious doctrine is a description of the truth in the world, I still say that in order to appreciate any kind of supernatural fantasy or horror fiction, you have to have what I think it was Coleridge called the temporary willing suspension of disbelief, the poetic faith. You just have to put what you really believe about the world on the shelf, or you're never going to get anywhere enjoying it. Well, actually, in any movie, any drama, you have to sort of get into it. Peter Berger calls it a finite province of meaning. When it's over, when the end comes up on the screen, okay, you snap out of it. You were willing, however, for the duration to sort of perceive and receive this as if it were real. Well, if you're a devout Christian, you shouldn't have any trouble with Lovecraft or vampires or whatever, because you don't believe they're real. right? I mean, you might believe that the devil is real and so on, but even there, if you know something is a fiction, it's frightening because it's a different understanding of reality. And if you think that it's fun to be momentarily frightened, and I think it is, to excite the range of emotions, kind of like Aristotle said, that the theater cleanses the soul of pity and terror by means of pity and terror. Well, it's altogether wholesome. There are movies and I guess books that are degrading, but that's a bit of a different story. You can put your mind in the gutter, but that's not what you're doing with Lovecraft by any stretch. Mm-hmm. Now, so I didn't really see a conflict. Years later, I began to understand, partly through a great essay by Fritz Leiber, that the whole worldview of Lovecraft, which pretty much is embodied in his fiction, is similar or really identical to the essence of religious experience, according to Rudolf Otto and others. Namely, it's the mysterium tremendum, the great mystery at which we tremble, like Moses being afraid to look at God, Isaiah in the temple seeing God on his throne and saying, "Woe is me, I am undone," etc., etc. This, you can find examples of holy terror in all religions, ancient and modern, from Asclepius and Serapis worship to the Bhagavad Gita, etc., etc., etc. And the idea is that in the basic religious experience, you're encountering the holy other and the infinite, and it makes you recognize in humility your mere creaturehood, that in the scheme of things, you don't amount to an atom. I think just studying astronomy can drive that home pretty fast. Like Eric Idle's character said, sort of makes you feel insignificant, doesn't it? No, I guess that was that wasn't Eric Idle. That was Terry Jones.
Yes.
Well, Leiber said is exactly right, that it's almost the cosmicism or the futilitarianism, as Sprague de Camp calls it, of Lovecraft. I am nothing. I have to recognize that. I am not the center of all things, as I would like conceitedly to think. The human race is not the center of all things. The difference is that, even the other side of that coin, the mysterium fascinans, the great unknown is terrifying, but also endlessly fascinating. This is a reaction anybody has in a particularly rough horror movie. You cover your eyes, but you start peeking through your fingers. You're afraid of it, and yet you've got to see it. And that's just what happens to Lovecraft's doomed protagonists. Well, in religion, the idea is that you are fascinated by the great mysterium because you sense that it offers fulfillment. You're terrified because your pitiful finitude is revealed, but at the same time, there is something greater, and perhaps you can participate in it, which religion provides means of doing. So I did an article once called Cosmic Fear and the Fear of the Lord, showing this kind of parallelism and how you can even see some remarks of Lovecraft in letters and stories that sound almost Buddhist, which has a similar vision. So I think the two go hand in hand, not that it would matter to me if they didn't. And I don't feel like I have to have some sort of monomania that everything's got to fit together, but I do see a great commonality between these two.
I think as a theme that sort of comes up in the new Godzilla film. I just got back from watching that with my son this morning. There's Godzilla destroying the city, and at the same time, people are piling up to worship him as a god because it's an awesome destructive force which they can't understand, and worship is one of the outward ways that they are able to deal with it. And I think they kind of touched on that a little bit in Del Toro's Pacific Rim to some extent. And it's about worship, at least treating the kaiju as though they were sacred in some way and medicinally powerful. But, you know, it's an interesting theme.
There's one of the hymns of the Rig Veda addressed to Rudra, a god of the terrifying power of nature. It's very much like the Monty Python scene in the same movie where they're in the chapel service and John Cleese is Michael Palin leading the prayer. Forgive us, Lord, for this our dreadful toadying. And then he starts singing this litany. Burn or fry us, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yeah, in this hymn to Rudra, a whole lot of it is do not destroy us, Rudra, because the power of nature could do just that. So sometimes worship is supplication out of fear, but probably the more refined version is the kind of thing Arthur Machen talks about explicitly, that there is this incredible deep mystery that even in its holiness could be too dangerous to experience, like the great god Pan.
So I have a question in two parts, and I'll do the first part. Maybe Karen can pick up part B.
Sure.
Since our show, a lot of it deals with cryptozoology, and I was wondering about Lovecraft's work predates cryptozoology as a sort of cultural phenomenon, but he does seem to pay attention to popular science and folklore. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could tell me, what stories do you think most closely correlate to popular cryptid stories that we have today? And I'm specifically thinking about reading that the Migo, the fungi from Yuggoth, or Migo is actually another name for Yeti. I know his version is very different because they're more lobster-like, but I wondered if there were any cryptid tales that are any stories that you thought closely correspond with cryptozoology.
Well, the Whisperer in Darkness to which you refer certainly does, because he has the element of people spreading rumors and mystifying reports about these weird, huge, lobster-like shapes washing down from the mountains in the spring thaw and so on. That's very much like the reports you still hear of lake monsters and the like. And people claim, yeah, they saw Bigfoot or some dinosaur in a river in Africa. And it's not unreasonable, but you'd need to catch or film at least one of these things. Well, that's the kind of buildup Lovecraft gives to the Migo in that story. So it sounds very much. And in fact, Akeley is an amateur anthropologist, and so this interests him, both the folklore about these creatures and the contact with them. Like, why the heck doesn't he get up and leave? Well, he's it's like the Mysterium Fascinans again. He can't bring himself to do that because he's in too deep. He's got to know. So I think that one is very much like cryptozoology, one that has in our day come to be closely coincident with cryptozoology would be the shadow over Innsmouth. I'm not sure that there were any speculations about or claimed witnesses of mermaids and all that. I mean, those seem to be so old as far as I know that they kind of just would qualify as legends, like leprechauns. I don't know if anybody's claiming to see leprechauns, at least when they're sober. Well, but recently, a few years ago, there were these pseudo-documentary things. I don't know, were they even on National Geographic or something about these mer people? And boy, did they make it sound like they were really telling you. But it was really like Orson Welles and War of the Worlds. Unless you happen to catch the disclaimer, they were really trying to make you think that there were these sea apes that evolved into a different human race. And that is, I don't think they got the idea from Lovecraft, but that is almost retroactively making the shadow over Innsmouth into a tale of cryptozoology. Some of the other ones, like with Cthulhu and all that, they're just monster stories. Like there's no real connection with actual belief Whereas in that one, you've got the religious angle. He sort of pokes fun at theosophy and the like in that one. And Adventists, the Millerites, people sense that some great thing is about to happen, and they gather wearing white sheets on hilltops waiting for the great eschaton. Well, supposedly people did that in the 1840s with the Adventist hope that didn't pan out, or in the Shadow Out of Time, that is completely based on Madame Blavatsky and theosophy, which Lovecraft learned of from E. Hoffman Price. But I'm trying to think if any others have a cryptozoological sort of connection.
Well, you reminded me that to some extent, the Call of Cthulhu. Cthulhu himself is more based on historical legends of the Kraken. I think lately the Kraken's sort of been reinterpreted as being a giant squid, but originally it was more like the sort of island floating, that you land on the island, you find out, oh, it's not an island at all, it's actually an animal. So I'm curious, I guess in that sense, that maybe that's also has some relationship.
Yeah, that could well be. I really enjoyed seeing the Kraken show up in that Geico commercial and doing grabs all the golfers and so on. And,
I think the Adventures of Baron Munchausen, they go inside the giant animal. That's kind of that's more how I pictured the Kraken is, or just so big as to be. Well, that's a mountain walked or stumbled, right? I mean, it's big, really big.
So if Lovecraft were alive today and writing today, do you think that he would have incorporated the Chupacabra and Bigfoot type stories into his work?
Well, it certainly would be in harmony with what he actually did, so I sure wouldn't be surprised. That would make a lot of sense. I mean, he's almost verging on that in The Curse of Yig, where he said these legends of this father of serpents and all that. And I think he probably would. I don't know if this is an extrapolation from that kind of thing, but I did this story called Digging Up Doomsday, which was based on the mound, combining it with with the robot versus the Aztec mummy.
Wow.
Because both of them have something like an Aztec mummy and all that. But though it was ridiculous, that could have qualified as like one of his revision tales where he was kind of kidding around with it. I did one that's, I guess, just come out in a tribute collection to Ramsey Campbell, a bunch of stories based on the inhabitant of the lake. And my story in there is called In Search of Lake Monsters, which probably was actually a title of one of these things in the 70s. And though in this case, the lake monster is Glocky, one of the old ones. And I put it in terms of a film crew coming there to do a documentary, and they go to Brychester University because there's a folklorist there who's devoted his life to the study of this. And so it's very easy, in other words, to do Lovecraftian stuff with today's interest in these things. So yeah, I imagine he would have done more with it.
Nice.
Very good.
Let's see here. So speaking of that sort of thing, we've got, In the Dreams of the Witch House, we've got the old witch, Keziah Mason. She has this familiar called Brown Jenkin. And I think, we definitely talked about Brown Jenkin and this idea when we did our episode on this creature called Jeff the Talking Mongoose. And there was an episode called What's Good for the Mongoose, where we looked into the history of that. That all took place around the right time. I'm just curious, is there any evidence that would link Lovecraft to... And link Lovecraft having known about this Jeff the Talking Mongoose story and the creature Brown Jenkin? Do you know anything that we might?
Well, about 30 years ago, Will Murray did an article on this for my fanzine or whatever it is, the Crypt of Cthulhu, where he said that he thought Lovecraft very likely got the idea from Jeff, the talking mongoose. But as I remember, he didn't say Lovecraft ever actually mentions it, but he argues that given the popularity of it in the general area, that Lovecraft would almost have to have known about it. So he thinks by circumstantial evidence, it's more likely than not that that was the basis of Brown Jenkin.
Do you happen to have a copy of that that we could like just that article maybe we could link to in the show notes or
I not, yeah know. I have it somewhere though not in electronic form.
Okay.
I don't even know what issue it was in. I could check with Will and see if he has it in any electronic form.
That would be awesome. I'd love to read it even if if it's okay to put it on the show notes, it'd be fantastic, but if it's not I would just be delighted to read it. Yeah, I know several researchers have talked to me about the possibility of trying to find out if the newspapers were printing the story in the area where Lovecraft was living at the time. You know, again, that would still be circumstantial, but I'm very curious about how prominent the story was at the time, but it certainly seemed to get a lot of play, at least in the UK.
Well, that is what Will Murray delved into. I just can't remember the specifics, but I think he did come up with stuff like that.
Fantastic.
Our next question is about a paragraph long, so I'll try and cut it down a little bit. So it's in regards to the dreams in the witch house. And so this listener was concerned with the part where the protagonist repels a witch with a cheap crucifix. So this person was wondering if Lovecraft was maybe influenced by the film version of Dracula, where there's a similar scene.
He might have been. In fact, that's the biggest point of the biggest question in connection with that story, because Lovecraft seems to just regard conventional religion as whether Christianity, Judaism, Islam, he mentions all of them as just confused anticipations of what would be discovered or a merciful cloaking of the terrible truth in mythological terms. So if he introduces Nyarlathotep as the black man of the witch's Sabbath, is he really going to have a crucifix drive him away? I mean, that seemed everybody just real strange. And if he, I heard an interesting theory about this from a friend of mine, Ed Babinski, who's an expert in the creation versus evolution debates and the ancient history and biblical studies. He's works in the Furman Library down in South Carolina. He suggested that it was possible that what Lovecraft had in mind was the fact that the cross would have right angles and that that runs afoul of the oddly angled universes in which the old ones dwell. That's not obvious, but it's I'd have to say that in terms of the logic of the story, by default, that's the best theory I've ever heard. Though he may have gotten the crucifix thing from Dracula, I wouldn't be surprised, though the question remains, why the heck would he put it in there? This is the kind of thing Dirk Mozig sneered at in his essay, H.P. Lovecraft Mythmaker, where he just really blasted August Derleth and his version of the old ones and versus the elder gods. And he says that the star stones that Derleth has the good guys use, it's as cheap, puerile as the use of crucifixes in bad vampire movies. You'd think Lovecraft would have shared that view, so why did he do it? And my guess is, and again, this is not that compelling, that he's nodding to Frank Belknap Long, who had in The Space Eaters an epigraph that was cut out for the original Weird Tales publication, but which Lovecraft would have seen in manuscript, in which it's a quote from the Necronomicon of John Dee. That's a long added that little element that John Dee had translated it, or he might have even thought Dee had written it. I don't know. But he says, the cross is a potent symbol which has often appeared above our Sabbaths and dispelled whatever we were conjuring up. And I think he didn't have that. Long didn't have that firm grasp on the developing mythology, or he didn't care. Why should he? But I have a hunch that the role of the cross in that story is a nod to Long's Necronomicon passage, since he did pick up the John Dee thing. I'm guessing he picked up the at-homeness of the cross as an apotropaic agent driving away evil from Long. But I don't know. That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
So there used to be, this is sort of an opinion question, there was a time when there was very little Lovecraft on the big screen. And I think whether that was because of the content or because of how difficult it would have been to bring the special effects to play, I'm not sure. But now there's lots. Are there any of those films that you feel like are essentials, that if people who like the stories would really enjoy the pictures, or which do a better job of conveying the Lovecraftian feel?
Well, the Lovecraft Historical Society's film of The Call of Cthulhu I like very much. And I have not yet, I'm ashamed to say, seen their version of The Whisperer in Darkness, but I'm sure that would satisfy the Lovecraftian fans. Beyond that, I thought the film Cthulhu, which is really kind of an updated version of The Shadow Over Innsmouth, I thought on the whole that was really very effective. I mean, it's inspired by it. It's not all that faithful to it in specifics, but I thought they filled in a real world context that I guess they felt they had to make a modern film out of it. And yet you still like one thing I thought was great about it. The protagonist is the alienated son of a cult leader who believes in the old ones and all of that. And he's disappointed in his son because he's gay, for one thing. Well, I don't know why that would offend any Lovecraftian cult leader. And he doesn't believe in the family religion. He thinks it's just a bunch of hokum. Well, there's a scene where, because of a funeral, the guy goes back to his home and they're having dinner with the family. And his father is trying to argue him into believing in the cult of Dagon or whatever. And somebody really did their homework, because it sounds like a real member of an kind of a weird religion making a respectable sounding case for it. And then weird things happen. And when the Cthulhu apocalypse actually comes, they don't have the budget to do like what Del Toro would do. And yet it's very effective. And I have to really hand it to them. I think this movie Cthulhu, I think all Lovecraft fanatics ought to see that. There are other ones, but I have to admit, the more I see them, the more I really like the big three from the late 60s, Die, Monster, Die, based on The Color Out of Space, then The Dunwich Horror, and The Haunted Palace, based on Charles Dexter Ward. They're pretty loose adaptations, but they kind of have a lot going for them, and I guess they're still my favorites.
I think there's some that sort of just sort of tangentially touch on it. There's a film called The Beyond by Fulci, the Italian director, and it's got a book called The Book of Ibon, which shows up in there. And then it's it does a really good job of creating a very surreal feel. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. It's not a film. It's strange. I don't know that I can recommend it to everyone, because it's a lot of Italian films from the 80s are almost like, let's set up this horror scene and set up this horror scene and set up this horror scene and loosely tie them together and it'll be a film. But it's more about pulling off the gags, if you will, than about a really tight narrative. But the funny effect is that if you watch The Beyond, because of that loose feel, it becomes really surreal, because it almost seems like a dream, how in a dream you can hop from one place to another and to another. And the ending is deeply unsatisfying in a way that I think Lovecraft would have been very proud of. So I would say that's one you might want to check out. And then you made a pick the other day with David Niven, and I picked it up. I haven't had a chance to watch, and I say the other day. It was probably technically the other year, but I was listening to the Lovecraft Geek episodes, and it was one where David Niven, and there's a cult scene in the woods, and you said it was streaming. I picked it up, but I haven't watched it. Do you remember that one?
Eye of the Devil, probably.
Eye of the Devil, that's the one. Okay, so that's on my to-watch list.
Oh, what a movie. It's, yeah. In my opinion, it's like, it's the same theme as The Wicker Man, and equally impressive, but ooh, totally wow. different. I was just talking to my daughter about this. I showed it to her last October. She and I have these monster horror film festivals the whole of October.
Nice.
And she's out in Minneapolis now, though. So she watched Eye of the Devil again the other day. And I remember, oh, boy, in the late 70s, early 80s, way late at night, I was flipping through the channels. I happened to see a scene where Deborah Carr is out in the woods visiting a mausoleum of their family, and carving into the seal of it is this thing that says, there are... I would be saved, and I would save something or other, but 12 dance on high. He who danceth not knoweth not what cometh to pass. I thought, what is that? And I just wrote it down. I didn't know what movie I was watching, and it was impossible to tell. And so I later, years later, was reading an apocryphal New Testament book, The Acts of John, and there it was, in a ritual called the Round Dance of the Savior. It's a Gnostic sort of a thing, and the 12 are the apostles, and that is fascinating in its own right. Well, this movie dealt with that. Years later, in 1981, I was at a reception after a philosophy and religion department discussion, and that's where I met Carol, who I'm married to now, and I was watching it, and she came over. We were talking a bit, and then I needed to take somebody else home. I was driving back, and I thought, gee, if I turn off here, I can go back to the apartment there and talk to this girl again, or I can go home and watch the rest of the movie that I saw the beginning of there. And I thought, I'll go back and talk to her, and now we've been married for 30 years. And
wow.
So that movie the right means choice.
A lot to me. But even without that, it is fascinating. It's based on a book called, well, it's under different titles, 13... The Eye of the Devil, and I think there's yet another one. It's by Philip Lorraine, and it goes into more of the mystery religion background, but you don't really need to know it to find it to be a kind of a breathless, surreal experience seeing this. It's just terrific.
I'm really looking forward to it. That sounds great.
Yeah. No. Now I've got a much more general question, and that is, what do you feel defines a Lovecraft story?
I think of them as Faustian mysteries. There's this idea that some strange question pops up. Gilman studying non-Euclidean geometry, finding out about how Keziah Mason must have known about it. Gee, I got to find out what's going on here, and so on. Or the guy in The Call of Cthulhu reads this manuscript. It looks at this file of stuff that his uncle had put together, and he says, what's going on here? And again and again, Blake sees the steeple in the distance on College Hill, and just has to go find out what's there, and he finds the Necronomicon and so forth. So a mystery is afoot, as they say, and the more you dig into it, the more frightening, the more philosophically disillusioning, and finally the more dangerous it becomes. But you are willing to accept the results, take the risk, or even if it isn't a risk, even if you know damnation lies that way, you've got to know. So there's this idea of Faust, that he'll sell his soul to Mephistopheles if he can only find out the truth, etc. And I think that's to me, that's what characterizes most of his fiction.
Okay, very interesting.
Awesome. So after Lovecraft, this is another one of our questions from the internet. After Lovecraft, which authors and stories do you think most faithfully captured Lovecraftian mood and feel?
One of my favorites is Derleth's The Lurker at the Threshold. I think he does a good job of genuinely pastiching Lovecraft in the first two-thirds of it, because it's like a serial novel. It could easily have been published as three separate stories, but in fact it wasn't. But the third part of it veers off the track and gets into the stuff that Derleth gets maligned for, the good guys versus the bad guys and so forth. So I talk about hubris. Many years ago, I decided I would write a new third section of it that would carry it on more consistently in a Lovecraft direction, and it was called The Round Tower. I wouldn't have bothered if I hadn't have thought the beginning of it was genuinely, effectively Lovecraftian. He did other ones that Derleth did, a lot of other ones that are kind of pot boilers, but loads of fun to read, and many of them do have a Lovecraftian ambiance, though they're definitely second or third rate attempts. Robert Bloch, I think, sticks the closest in his early work, and there he's got the very much the same range of dangers and secrets, and his occult books like De Vermis Mysterious and Cult des Ghouls, which people always think August Derleth wrote because it was supposed to be written by the Comte Derleth, but that was Bloch's invention. That's a shout out to Derleth. And I think he did a great job. And here I got to mention something else about a movie. Just the day before yesterday, I watched Dark Intruder from about 1960 or so. This was an hour-long failed pilot for a TV show that I wish they had picked up. Leslie Nielsen is the main character, and he plays an occult investigator in Victorian-era San Francisco. And it's got definite Lovecraft and Bloch influences. The guy starts saying, well, this kind of idol comes from the Hogar region where they worshiped gods like Azathoth and Dagon. And I thought, what? I can't believe this. Why have I never heard of this? And later on, some guy's invoking the mindless chaos, and there's various things that make it clear somebody here was a fan of Lovecraft and Bloch both, and it's really a good thing, a good movie. I'm just so sorry that didn't get a permanent slot. But Bloch, I think, is great. Other people start going in other directions, like Brian Lumley very quickly took a lot of Lovecraft that he liked, but began to spin it out with all kinds of influences, like Edgar Rice Burroughs on the one hand, The Wizard of Oz on the other. Some of his stuff sounds more like loony, like EC Comics, and I love all of it, but some people just can't forgive him. Oh, it's not exactly like Lovecraft. Look, does it have to be? What do you? Ramsey Campbell, I think, remains very faithful in spirit from his early work to his later work. Today, the Joe Pulver has a novel. His first one, Nightmare's Disciple, is very much genuinely Lovecraftian, and in a hard-boiled detective hybrid, it's very effective. And two of my favorite writers besides Joe today are Cody Goodfellow, who just, this guy's a literary alchemist. The way he melds techno thrillers and hard-boiled detective with splatterpunk and genuine Lovecraftian vision, this guy is an inspired madman. he beats me at my own game, by the way. He does Cthulhu prayer breakfast better than I ever did.
Wow.
And by the way, he's an extra on American Horror Story this season.
Neat.
So, I mean, you got Cuba Gooding, you got Lady Gaga. Who cares? I want to see more Cody Goodfellow.
It surprised me. I haven't heard Splatterpunk was a big thing in the 80s with the John Craig and Skip Spector wrote a lot of books I really liked. And I haven't heard that phrase in a while. I love it. So,
well, in fact, Cody co-wrote something or other with Skip.
Oh, neat.
And his two-parter, Radiant Dawn and Ravenous Dusk, is incredibly good. I just cannot get over the excellence of that Lovecraftian work. And then Laird Barron, this guy, incredible. He does just the right thing. He often has a true Lovecraftian vision and feeling, but he doesn't start throwing all the regular names at you. And I think that's the wise course, because otherwise you're going to read Cthulhu Yog-Sothoth. What, again? Like, there's too much of it. I love that stuff, but there's way too much of it, and it just becomes, it's like your car flooding. You can't get anywhere unless you try to do something new, and he does. Mark Rainey often goes in a genuinely Lovecraftian visionary direction.
Okay, that's interesting, because, you know, Jack Laird, Laird is the last name, was one of the producers or co-producers of Night Gallery, which did a lot of Lovecraft stuff. So
I think he had something to do with Dark Intruder also.
Interesting. Oh, you know, and so Jeb Card had actually recommended Dark Intruder just a couple of weeks ago, and I put it down in my to-watch list and still haven't watched it yet, so definitely will. You know what I think? Ambitious for me to say this, but what I'll try to do is, in the show notes for this episode, put a list of all the direct Lovecraft movies that I can find, and then sort of like the one generation off inspired stuff.
It's going to be a long list.
Cram as many as I can into the show notes for people to take a look at. I love all of them, because I appreciate the effort, but I mean, I never really glommed on to like the Stuart Gordon stuff, because of the way it added in sexuality to the stories, and I kind of preferred them as sort of these raw intellectual asexual type adventures, and there didn't really seem to be a lot of that in the original Lovecraft tales, except there's this sort of weird implication that happens in Shadow Over Innsmouth that they don't really explicitly state, but I have to assume that since a lot of this is hybridization between humans and fish people, that wasn't an entirely consensual affair. So, but like that's not really explored very much. So,
like Lavinia's blind date with Yog-Sothoth.
A good point. Yes, sort of. Exactly. Necronomicon, the date rape drug. You know.
You guys are geeks for sure.
Oh yeah.
So we've got a monster related question here. So, what do you think Lovecraft was using as inspiration for his monsters?
Well, I do think, though I don't believe he explicitly mentions it anywhere, I could be wrong, I think the Kraken certainly is a biggie. To some degree, Wilbur Whately was inspired by Helen Vaughn in Macken's The Great God Pan. Not so much an outward appearance, but the idea of him being a blasphemous hybrid from the outer spheres, and then his death scene where he morphs and into a different state. That's clearly inspired by the end of The Great God Pan. The black goat of the woods with a thousand young, though that appears to be metaphorical, given the way Lovecraft describes Shub-Niggurath in a letter to Willis Conover as a cloud-like entity. It's hard to believe that isn't based on the Baphomet goat of medieval witchcraft and the Catholic version of the Knights Templar, the idea that they were ritually kissing the butt of the Baphomet. course, that was all nonsense because they didn't understand that Baphomet was just the old French spelling of Mahomet or Muhammad. And the idea was that the Templars had converted to Islam, and they didn't understand it, and it became just an outrageous thing. But at least we got the black goat of the woods out of it. Azathoth, it's possible that is based on either or both Anathoth, the hometown of the prophet Jeremiah. And that name is interesting, especially because it's the plural of Anat, the consort of Baal. She's mentioned all the time in the Old Testament because she was worshipped by Israelites. And so it's possible he had that in mind because he did read the King James Bible. Also, there was some astronomical or astrological book called Azoth, A-Z-O-T-H. So that's conceivable. Yog-Sothoth, it's, I know Richard Tyrie and others fictively equate him with Yahweh or Jehovah, but I'm not sure. And Lovecraft even associates the two in a letter where he says that I would contend that Jehovah is no more real than my Yog-Sothoth, but that doesn't really say that he got the idea from that. So I mean, you certainly got Thoth, although I don't believe you really pronounce it that way, from popular knowledge of Egyptian religion. Who we got left there? Nyarlathotep. That certainly, though he has no one form, though that's kind of the whole idea. He's kind of like Proteus. He certainly must have gotten at least the name from Lord Dunsany, because Dunsany mentions a prophet called Minarthitep and a god called Alhireth-Hotep. And he, though the name came to Lovecraft in a dream, I'd certainly bet that he got it came to him because he had these things, you know, ricocheting around in his subconscious mind. And Hastur, of course, they just borrowed that from Chambers, and Sathagwa from Smith. Where Smith got it, I'm not sure, but those, I guess that's the inspiration. Oh, by the way, speaking of monsters and old ones, Joe Broers, B-R-O-E-R-S, does these incredible sculptures of he did a great one from, I think it was he who did Brown Jenkin, which is statues of that are given out at the Lovecraft Film Festival. But he's done a great King in Yellow one, of all sorts of sculptures. And his latest one is of Ran Tegoth, the much neglected old one who appears in the horror in the museum. And it's really terrific. And he sells these things, and they can be ordered off of his site in DeviantArt. And so if other idolaters out there want to beef up their blasphemous and detestable altars at home, you might want to get the likeness of Ran Tegoth.
Well, one of the things that this is not directly from one of our listeners, but the idea, like the way that Lovecraft has influenced so many other writers, you talk about that a little bit. Well, actually, you talk about it quite a bit on your other episodes, but it may be new to our listeners. I guess one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, when my kids are growing up, they always think, oh, well, so-and-so ripped off that idea from someone else, and they ripped off that idea from this other person. It's like, I used to think that way about Lovecraft, but it seems more like that it's like a virus that's infected American literature. Would you care to talk about that a little bit, about the way it's grown and spread throughout American horror literature and maybe even in science fiction some?
Yeah, there's a phrase in one of Lovecraft's stories, I think of the Dunwich Horror, that studying the Necronomicon or the death of Wilbur Whately or some kind of big thing promises to open up new lines of inquiry in metaphysical and other matters. Well, that's kind of what happened with Lovecraft's work that it opened up new possibilities and new lines of literary dissent, because any fool can see, if you've read any of Algernon Blackwood or Arthur Machen or Lord Dunsany, you can see that right in Lovecraft. I mean, in fact, so much of my favorite Lovecraft story, The Dunwich Horror, comes right out of Arthur Machen, plus some other stuff like Harper Williams' thing in the woods, and various other things crossbred with the lore of the Jersey Devil and all sorts of things. It's very much like Derleth's use of Lovecraft. I mean, there is so much of it in there. Well, would it be? I mean, so people often say, look at Derleth, he just ripped off Lovecraft. Like you say, I cannot see it that way anymore. Whether he did it well or badly is another issue, though I like his stuff. But did Lovecraft rip off Machen? Of course not. He liked what he saw and said, boy, I bet I could do something interesting with that. I'm glad when that happens. I don't view it as a lack of originality. The originality comes with what you go on to do with it. And like, I love Robert E. Howard and Conan and King Cull and all that. I love Edgar Rice Burroughs, John Carter of Mars. And I love Lynn Carter, who decided to hybridize Burroughs and Howard and wrote these Thongor books. And I love it. He did a great job. Oh, but it wasn't completely original. Who the hell cares? What are you, the copyright office? And it's not stealing it. It's obviously an homage. And the same thing with Lovecraft. And it does continue to evolve. Like I mentioned with Laird Barron, for example, or Pulver or Goodfellow, these guys are doing their own thing. And yet there is definite Lovecraft inheritance in it. I love to see this stuff evolve. And there is such a thing as Lovecraftian fiction, ostensibly Lovecraftian fiction, that really just throws a few names in and it really has nothing to do with it. Well, that I'm not too interested in, though, you know, it's neither here nor there, but you sort of want to see new things done with it. And not because you're tired of the old, but it's the next best thing to Lovecraft still being around and evolving himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a question about the theater. So have there been any successful stage adaptations of Lovecraft?
I don't know. I know there have been a couple of stage productions about Lovecraft himself, but I've never seen any. So I can't really comment. I mean, it's the same with most of these movies. That there's so many of them, I no longer even try to keep up with that. So I'm a bad one to ask about that.
Sure.
It does, with each generation that takes some of these materials and riffs on them, it gets really difficult to keep track of. It expands and expands. So I imagine that because of the nature of copying and people reproducing, it will become exponentially difficult to do so.
I find that already. I just, here's another mythos anthology. Well, it'd probably be real good, but I haven't read Lovecraft himself in 20 or 30 years. I got to get back to that. I'd rather do that. And it's just history has passed me by already. And I'm not complaining, but it's a whole new world, a brave new world that hath such Lovecraftians in it.
I often wish I could live forever, not because I think I'm great, but just because there's so much to read I need to catch up on. So
too little time.
Well, Lovecraft himself said that's the big reason not to commit suicide. There's too much interesting to experience and find out about. You don't really need meaning if you've got fun.
That's fun. So one of our listeners would like to know, and I apologize to our listeners, by the way, I kind of copied all these questions into a document to keep track of them and then failed to keep people's names with it. So
you can make up names.
Thanks, Lovecraft. Thanks,
Henry Akeley asks.
So what is Lovecraft's relationship with science and skepticism?
Well, he certainly took a dim view of all this stuff. He and C.M. Eddy wrote this book, The Cancer of Superstition. I think it was to be published under Houdini's name, just as he wrote Imprisoned with the Pharaohs / under the Pyramids. Ghost wrote it for Houdini, but he had nothing for that kind of thing. He would have been great on this skeptic panel at Dragon Con. He thought that he had dreams, for instance, that he said another might interpret as memories of a previous life, but he kind of laughed that off, and he didn't have any regard for the truth claims of religion, though he was not hostile to religion. He thought it served a good social purpose, and I don't think he had anything. And this recurrent myth that Lovecraft was an occultist and a member of the Golden Dawn is pure fantasy. It's like an urban legend. So he was, by his own repeated emphatic confession, a naturalist, an atheist, a rationalist, a materialist. So he thought Plato had ruined philosophy with his world of form. So he was the big time skeptic.
So I was going to say the Houdini thing. There was recently they found the manuscript of what was it? The
I think it was that Cancer of Superstition thing.
Yeah.
And I, from what I read, though, I'm forgetting some of it now, it wasn't that big a deal that most of that material was already known. Somebody who just didn't know that thought it was this major discovery. I'm not sure if there's any new material in it or if we now have the whole work. I don't know if they ever finished it, but we've never had the whole thing. If this is it, I hope so, but I doubt if I'd ever get around to reading it anyway.
No worries. Thanks.
Okay, just a final few questions here. So this person asks, I heard that Lovecraft evolved on his racist and xenophobic views near the end of his life. Is this accurate or just wishful thinking?
I know he did go in the direction of socialism very clearly, but I think it's kind of a wishful thinking myth that he got over racism. Sprague de Camp in his biography indicated that he had, but S.T. Joshi, who of course is the great partisan of Lovecraft, admitted that no, any kind of reading of his letters toward the end of his life make it clear he hadn't changed his mind on that. At least it was in the abstract with him, because he had Jewish friends and complimented an African-American artist and all that. So when he met individuals, he seemed to give him an even break. But of course, the racism he espoused is disgusting. People make such a big deal out of that, I think, because they're hero worshipers of Lovecraft, and they don't want there to be clay feet. Whereas I feel like if we knew nothing about Lovecraft, if we had no letters, no memoirs of him by his friends, and just had his fiction, that's all I'd be interested in. I mean, as an individual, he is interesting, but I don't really. I mean, Heidegger was a member of the Nazi Party. That's pretty bad, but I just don't see how that affects being and time and his philosophy and all that. I mean, if it was predicated on racism, anti-Semitism, Nazism, that'd be another thing. But it isn't. So, you know, what the heck? It's too bad. Maybe they're roasting in hell now, but that, you know, I'm only interested in the writings, really.
That's a really interesting point. I think, especially lately on social media, it becomes very easy to sort of write people off for something that's wrong with what they do. So you make them an outcast because of something. But people are complicated. I mean, everybody's complicated. And the good that we do and the bad that we do, people don't know the full nature of it. I think this is something as an English major that came up a lot was, is it possible to enjoy the works and at the same time repudiate the character of the person who wrote them? And I think it is. I think you can just compartmentalize if you try. Enjoy a book if you like it. If you don't like the author's views, reading their work, maybe with the exception of Mein Kampf, is generally okay. You've got to keep them apart.
And that's just what I'm saying. It's not true about Heidegger. He was a Nazi, but it doesn't show up in his work. No damn good as a person, but I just don't. He's not. It's like Being in Time is not Mein Kampf. It isn't about that stuff. And in fact, it's an elementary thing in literary criticism to speak of the distinguishing between the actual author, the implied author, and the narrator. They can be very different people, and you can start inferring things about the author that may not be true of the real author because they're consciously writing from a certain pose. I mean, an extreme example, like I know a guy that, Stefan Aletti, who wrote a whole bunch of horror stories from the standpoint of women and sometimes specifically of lesbians. He did this on a dare because he was in a bookstore and he was happening to look over this bin of lesbian paperbacks, and this woman next to him said, "You have no business reading this. You could never write it." And he said, "Oh yeah?" And so he started writing these things and getting them published under a pseudonym, and so the implied author is not necessarily the real author. And so if it happens that it is, it doesn't really make any difference. Aren't you interested in the implied author, the standpoint from which it is written, and then the narrator, what he says and all that, she says? But it's just to confuse this shows a fundamental error in literary criticism.
I guess it's just like being able to watch Tom Cruise in a movie.
Well, yeah, that's a good point.
Do you really care if he's a Scientologist while you're watching, Mission Impossible or something? I don't.
It comes up the Arthur Conan Doyle, and you know, here you have Sherlock Holmes, who's this incredible rationalist, and you've got Arthur Conan Doyle, who embraces the world of spiritualism and magic. Hmm. And it shocks people when they think that Doyle himself is Sherlock Holmes. You know, it shocks them to find out, no, he was very human and he had very emotional views about the supernatural, and the author is not the character. They're not the same. And, you know, I think some of Lovecraft's xenophobia is kind of a core component of the horror that he has, but and not every one of his stories I enjoy when that creeps in, but I love a lot of his work and I'm able to keep those things apart, you know? So I feel okay about that. Anyway, I didn't want to rant, but I thank you for sharing your views on that. And I'm sure you've answered the question of our listener. So we've got sort of a final question that, and by the way, for our listeners, Bob's show is kind of dependent on getting questions. So if you want to hear further episodes of the Lovecraft Geek, you need to send him your questions. And I'm sure if he gets enough of them, he'll pick up and do new episodes. If you don't want me speaking for you, Bob.
No, that's exactly right. I've got about 3 questions. That's not going to take me very long. And I like doing the Lovecraft Geek, but I got plenty of other stuff to do. But if anybody does enjoy it, they could help out by sending in some questions.
Although you could certainly spread out 3 questions over a show. If anyone could, it would be you.
Right, you are.
So the final question, Bob, can you recommend any particular monster film for our listeners for Halloween?
Well, I always make sure I watch Bela Lugosi in Mark of the Vampire, Return of the Vampire, in both of which he pretty much plays Dracula, and it's great to see more of him. And I always watch Brides of Dracula, which is a Hammer film, but Christopher Lee is not in it, but it's my favorite of those. It's just really terrific. And I often try to squeeze in Curse of the Werewolf. Now, I got to say, though, that usually I am watching stuff all October, and I try to watch all the major Universal horror movies. So if I weren't doing that, I guess I would just simply watch 5 or 6 of those back to back on Halloween itself.
Well, I've been following you on Facebook, and you've certainly been busy watching movies.
It's one of my favorite times of the year. I'm trying to catch up on some of my Italian horror myself. So I've got some core you know, classics that I that are still not under my belt. They've been in my collection for a long time. I'm trying to get those done. So that's fantastic. Yes. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And
yeah, thank you. Your knowledge is just so impressive.
It really is.
Well, I'm pleased to do it. Thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. So again, we'll put links to your show in the show notes.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk, an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. You just heard Blake Smith and Kieran Stolzno interviewing author and scholar Robert Price about H.P. Lovecraft as part of a special Monster Talk Lovecraft Geek crossover. Links to many movies and books will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org, as well as links to Bob's podcast, The Lovecraft Geek. Monster Talk is an official Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed here are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. To see those views of Skeptic Magazine, you may survive a huge storm out in the Pacific, and then, if fate's in your favor, you're washed up on the slimy shore of a mysterious island in the midst of strange cyclopean architecture, where you find soggy copies of old issues beneath the clattering multi-legged creatures that defy classification. Or you can subscribe by visiting skeptic.com. But that approach will never get you the really good stuff. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind.